Could you please speak a little bit about renunciation?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly relevant, of course, also what's coming up for you. Did you hear that? What Jean-Christophe suggested was a few reflections on the theme of renunciation. That word is quite an important term, not only particularly in our tradition and or within our lifestyle. The monk's lifestyle is, of course, a lifestyle of renunciation per se. We also call it renunciates, is the English word renunciates. Those people have renounced worldly life, the normal pursuits of for happiness, which the average person goes after. We've given that up to some extent, maybe not completely, but at least the direction we're taking and monastics are taking is to renounce. Americans' constitution has the pursuit of happiness in their written down in their constitution. And I don't know how much it is pointed out what kind of happiness is actually meant by it. And well, I figure it's probably more the material happiness, happiness of, you know, material wealth. And then, of course, if you have material wealth, you can fulfill yourself all sorts of wonderful wishes, you can live in wonderful places, have a very nice house and drive a nice car, have wonderful things in your house, and you might even become more attractive to other people who would like to share your wealth with you. That usually goes along with it. So I think that's probably the kind of happiness is meant when it's put into a state constitution. But I'm not sure. Maybe even the spiritual, some spiritual aspects are also meant to come in there. But in this context, in our context, if we're talking about pursuit of happiness, which you could say also, you know, is one of the Buddhist orientations, even though it's very often not put like this, it's more usually put in a negative term, like the ending of dukkha, the ending of suffering. But when suffering ends, what's the result on the other side of the spectrum? When suffering ends, of course, and there's happiness, and there's really genuine happiness, true happiness, not just the fleeting happiness of the senses, of the sense world, the things which come and go, which are not really trustworthy and reliable, just of the mere fact that they do come and go, and there's no peace to be found within that. There's no lasting satisfaction to be found within that. So, and very often people who take on the renunciate life, to some extent, they have sensed that or felt that or have kind of been sobered by their life so far, up to a particular point in life, where they've maybe even given it a good bash and tried all sorts of gratifications out of the sensual world, but things don't seem to quite give that lasting satisfaction or contentment which one was hoping for. So then of course one ends up asking the question, so what now? Where does it go? Is that all? Is that it? You know, the sensual gratification, having a good time, and but that most people are making the experience of having a good time all of the time, but some of the time. But even if, you know, if things go really well and you have most of your wishes fulfilled and you're getting what you want in life to, you know, maybe 75%, which is very high already, then still you can end up with a question, so what? You know, is this it? Is this what is life all about? And then that can lead you, of course, into the spiritual domain. Because the spiritual domain has very different values and very different, fundamental orientation. It's not about gratification of simple, ordinary, sensual happiness, worldly happiness. But it points to a happiness or a contentment or a satisfaction which is lasting, which doesn't come and doesn't go, which is truly trustworthy. And that's what it's pointing to, is the awakened heart. Only the awakened heart can provide that, can provide the lasting happiness which we all yearn for. This is an assumption. Of course, when I say we all yearn for it, but I mean, I'm even speaking for, when I say all, not only for the people in this room, but I would speak for any human being. All human beings yearn for lasting happiness and contentment. This is what everybody wants, really. Just as there are some people in this world who do it in a terrible, stupid way. Some people, even, you know, people who go to resort to crime, you know, to get a lot of money by committing a crime or so. They only do it because they're expecting some kind of, after they got all their money or whatever it is they've stolen or robbed, they're expecting some kind of happiness, strange kind of happiness, or an ending of some kind of pressure of suffering or dukkha, just to get a little bit of a release. But even if you would talk to someone like that in the quietness of, you know, maybe their room, their privacy, and have a quiet moment, they would have to admit that their heart's also yearning for something which is much more, goes much more beyond, you know, these kind of superficial forms of happiness. That they yearn for something in their heart which is also lasting and doesn't, is not so fickle and so changeable and so uncertain as worldly forms of happiness are. They are limited, and there's no doubt about it. And so it's very important, of course, to acknowledge that, not, of course, to say or pretend that there isn't happiness at all. There is certainly a form of what we call worldly or sensual happiness. You know, the senses can provide us with a certain amount of it, but to also acknowledge their limitations. It only goes to a certain point, and it's also limited by the duration. It only goes for so long. And it seems to be in the law of things that the more we want this, and or the more we grasp it, if we have it, the more we grasp it. If we don't have it, the more we want it, the more we suffer, isn't it? Because we don't have it, and we want it very often, we fail to arrive at a really satisfactory state. And if we have something which delights us, pleases us, finally fulfilled a wish has fulfilled itself, then we can see we get worried, we get afraid and anxious. Oh, I hope it will stay with me. It will last. It will not go away so quickly. And you can almost say, as soon as you start thinking such thoughts, things start to disintegrate. Hmm? The happiness which we are maybe innocently enjoying, just the happiness of just a simple, ordinary, daily happiness of a nice meal or of a nice experience in nature, of a nice encounter with another human being, or acquiring something which you really like on the material levels, the ultimate gadget or the ultimate thing you always wanted, then very soon, you know, when this thought arises, it goes flat. Hmm? And we're back into the same state of dissatisfaction and this very pervasive sense of lack. Have you ever felt that pervasive sense of lack in your life? Not even quite sure how to name it and what it is. You know, it's just something's lacking. I think a lot of people talk about this and have maybe had thoughts about it, and then of course try to do certain strategies to get rid of this feeling of lack, to fulfill themselves. So if you have a lack, then the best way to get rid of it is is to fulfill yourself with something which one expects would erase, delete this sense of lack for once and for all. But as long as we're still operating on this very superficial level, on the sensual level, on the worldly level, as we say, we're always coming back to square one. It's always the same cycle. And it seems to be that then if people start to get interested in the spiritual life, in meditation, very often, of course, their attitude gets transported into the spiritual domain. Because we maybe have understood intellectually, yes, I understand, it's not so difficult to understand, also it's not a real mastery to understand that intellectually, that, you know, a lot of our experiences are quite unsatisfactory. But then we transport that the same kind of attitude into the spiritual domain, into the world of meditation. And then we try to imagine some kind of special state. We try to reach a special state in our meditation. Or experience a wonderful penetrating insight which will dissolve all our problems once and for all just by, you know, the mere way how we engage in some kind of meditation practice and some method. And a lot of people have this attitude, at least initially, because they're still, of course, functioning on the value system of materialism. There was once a very good book written years ago. It was one of the first Buddhist books I ever read, which was called Spiritual Materialism by a Tibetan teacher. And years ago, it was in the 70s. It was very early on. That was a very early phase of Buddhism in the West. He was pointing to that fact. He could see that he'd already lived in the West for maybe 10, 15 years. And he'd observed that especially Westerners tend to get then very materialistic in their spiritual aspirations. So it means that the value system they have in their spiritual life is the same value system they had before in the worldly life, in normal life. Only they changed the objects. Instead of a nice car, a nice house, nice this, nice that, now you want nice mental, emotional states, satisfactory states in your meditation. But the basic attitude is the same, isn't it? You still want something which you don't have now. Would you imagine if you only do the right things, have the right meditation method and strategy, then it will come, it will provide you that, what you're longing for. And in a way, one could say this is a necessary, you could almost say it's a necessary stage to go through. But of course, when we're taking on Buddhist practice, especially Buddhist practice, then of course it becomes very clear, or should become very clear early on, that it's not just about a meditation method. It's not just about, you know, some special skill you develop in your mind, how to, you know, attend to your inner processes that will provide you the goods. It needs more than that. And so, in the Eightfold Path, the Buddha pointed out, which is the path to follow, to explore, to investigate, and to put into one's life, there's the second fifth factor, which belongs to the wisdom package in the Eightfold Path. There's two aspects. One is the right view. It's the first one. And the second one is right, I very often like to call it right orientation, or right intention, or sometimes also right thinking. That all comes into it. Our intentionality comes into it, our thinking. And basically what it's pointed to is how we are inwardly oriented, how we approach our life, and of course, more specifically, our spiritual life. And this right orientation has three aspects. It has benevolence, or in Buddhism we say metta, kindness, friendliness, loving kindness. It has compassion as a second aspect. And then the third aspect is renunciation. There it comes. Right, you know, early on in the Eightfold Path, there's this aspect of renunciation, which obviously, you know, it was deemed to be very important, because some other aspects, some other virtues or paramitas, as we say, could have been put in there, but it's renunciation besides benevolence and compassion. So, of course, there's the obvious question, why that? You know, why renunciation? And, of course, my humble understanding of it is that it's not the renunciation which, you know, like the monastics stand for, the renunciate, the renouncing of the world as such, even though it might come into it, and of course for us here in this monastery it comes into it, but it has to do with renouncing of all concerns on self, on me, on mine. This is the ultimate renunciation. And we all, of course, as human beings, we are entrapped, we are imprisoned by this view, this very fixed view of who we are, of self. You know, we would have called it sakyaditti, the self-view, personality view. We have a certain idea, we have images of ourselves, and we cling to it for life. We cling to it for life. We're very strongly attached to the way we see ourselves. And of course, in extreme forms, it can come out as egocentricity. People who are totally obsessed with themselves. We then call them, you know, people, they are egotistical. They're on an ego trip. They just know only themselves. They don't know anyone else. And of course, that's the most extreme form of holding a self-view, you could say. But then, of course, there are milder forms where people actually acknowledge that, you know, they have a kind of oppressive sense of, or you could say, exaggerated form of self-concern. You know, the thoughts and feelings always grating about me, myself, my happiness, my satisfaction, my dissatisfaction, my future, my past, my this, my that, you know. These are revolving thoughts and feelings around the concept of self. And usually, someone who's interested in Buddhism, the Buddhist teaching, gets made aware of that. What that is, and is asked, and it is suggested to investigate that. What is that? And also to ask, where is that self? What we are so desperately concerned about. Can you find it? Is it somewhere to be detected? Is it something which will show itself or reveal itself if we only, you know, find the right approach, the right technique? Then it comes, here it is. This is the ultimate self. This is who I truly am. And of course, I haven't met anyone who's come to that conclusion through Dhamma practice, through Buddhist practice. But the question is not a bad question. Because if we're asking ourselves, well, who am I? Or what is it, who I truly am? If we're asking ourselves that question, and of course we have to look at all the experiences we are having right now. The thoughts reliable? Is that who I am? And in one of the, you know, fundamental, the cardinal sutras of the Pali Canon, the Buddha speaks about the signs of non-self in the Natalakkhana Sutta. The Buddha speaks about and goes through the different aspects which make our personality, the so-called khandhas, the body, the feelings, the perceptions, the mental constructs and mental formations and consciousness. And he goes into a very nice dialogue with his disciples. It's a beautiful sutta where he speaks with his monks and asks them, well, if our body would be ourself, then we could, of course, determine, may my body only be like this. Eh? We would have control of our bodies. We could say, it should be like this. It shouldn't get old, you know. It shouldn't get sick. And after all, it shouldn't die. It should stay how I wanted it to be. And then he goes to the others, he goes to feelings. If you know, feelings would be myself, then I should have total control of it. I should be able to determine, I only want pleasant feelings, I don't want unpleasant feelings. So the feelings should only be like this, how I want them. They shouldn't be how I don't want them. But who can say that? Who can determine that feelings only come in a particular way, how I want them? Or perceptions, the perceptions we have, the memories we have. Can they be only in the way we want them? Or is there very, very limited? If at all control, the control is very, very limited. And then what the Buddha called the mental fabrications. What we create with our minds, the thoughts and so forth. They also come. Unpredictable. I can't predict the next thought I'm having. I can't say, I only want to have loving, kind, compassionate, wonderful thoughts. And yes, I would really, quite frankly, I'd really love that. But even if I would determine that, it wouldn't happen like that. There would still come silly thoughts, random thoughts, and sometimes even not so nice thoughts, which I won't tell you about. I can't control this. Things just happen because of conditions. And the conditions, of course, are our habits, our personality, structures and so forth, which we have developed over lifetime. And then, of course, the sensual impressions as well, the fifth aspect also, that we can't control. We can't say from now, I only want nice and wonderful things in my eyesight, and, in my what I hear, what I touch, what I feel, what I taste, what I smell, and so forth. Definitely not. We have a whole load of things which come in unpredictable ways. And so if that becomes clear, and of course if one goes through it like this, again, our intellectual understanding, to intellectually understand that, is that's not a masterpiece to do that, but of course, when the Buddha speaks like that, he's always pointing to and encouraging his monk to investigate that, to look deeply into that, not just superficially, but really look deeply. How much control do you have? How much control do you have of these aspects which make up your personality? And how strong and how fixed is that sense of self? How much do we rely on some kind of imagined entity somewhere? We don't even know where exactly. If I would ask, anyone, where do you think the true you is, the true self is? Where would you point to? Would you point to your heart? Or some people might point to their heads, Or some people might say, it's all of it, Even in the old days, there were people who were pointing outside of them and say that their self, the true self is outside of their own, the limits of their body. Or they would say, contradictory thing, that it's neither nor. It's everywhere, it's as well inside as outside. And people trying to kind of have, of course, a clever, evasive philosophical strategy to come up with something, satisfactory. But these things are silly, isn't it? It cannot be satisfactory. So the Buddha encouraged in this discourse his monks to investigate, to look into. He was leading them, it was a kind of a guided inquiry, leading them to look deeply. What is this sense of, what makes this sense of self? Because, of course, as I said, the act of renunciation as an act of will, as a declaration, yes, that is something which one can do and which monastics do. We take on a simple lifestyle, we renounce certain external things, we renounce certain, quite a lot of possessions initially and so forth, and take on just, few simple possessions in order to more direct the attention, direct ourselves to those aspects where the real renunciation has to take place. The real renunciation has to take place in our own hearts. It's not just an outside gesture of, okay, I give up driving cars and, dwelling in luxury and, going, traveling wherever I like, etc., etc. But the real renunciation is the renunciation of self, of me, of mine. And where does that lead us? Does that lead us to a kind of total confusion and disorientation that we don't know who we are anymore? You know, if I say, I renounce myself, you know, and or if worse, if I say I don't really exist, so I just give it all up, what then, what happens then? It can lead to confusion, can't it? Because on the structural level, on the functional level, of course, we do need a sense of self, we do need a personality, we need a kind of, you could even say an ego structure to function in the world. We still want to be fairly sure, you know, who we are. If someone calls me Kema Siri, I want to be fairly sure that this is this one who is meant, who is called, rather than pretending, you know, there's no self, I have no self, so I shouldn't really answer. And we use conventional reality in a skillful way, and the conventional reality shouldn't get in the way of the other reality towards this aspect of pointing. You could call it ultimate reality. In the ultimate sense, there are no selves there. Really, there is only inner processes coming and going, images coming and going, perceptions coming and going, and so forth. So where can we rest with all this? It just sounds a little bit disconcerting, doesn't it? If you just, all you are sounds like things coming and going all the time. Where can you rest? Where can you be? And be at peace with the flow of all this. And that's, of course, where specific practices or specific ways of looking at oneself come in very handy. We need a place to rest, or, as the Buddha pointed out, we need a refuge. And not a refuge in the external sense, again in the way of a formalized way, when we're taking we're going for refuge for Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Yes, that's wonderful and it's necessary and it's a necessary step. And also something we need to do repeatedly. It's not only just once that you do it, maybe to become a Buddhist, to formally declare, now I take refuge to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, I'm a Buddhist now. But what does it mean? Does it mean simply to belong to some kind of institution or organization? Or does it mean that what Buddha Dhamma and Sangha represent, that becomes your refuge? And I always like to reflect along these way, that the Buddha, when we're going for refuge to the Buddha, it's not only the historical Buddha Siddhartha Gautama, who lived 2,600 years ago, let alone an image made of wood or brass or stone or whatever. These are just symbols pointing to something. Just like the Buddha is pointing to something. The Buddha, the historical Buddha, has awakened himself. And what he stands now for, and when we take him, or we take Buddha as a refuge, we take refuge also in this awakened quality we have in our own, and in our own hearts, the ability to awaken. We all have this ability to wake up. We have Buddha nature, Buddha potential. We can all wake up. If we couldn't wake up, then I think we would be really in trouble. If there wouldn't be the potential to wake up, then where would we go? Where would be a refuge? If we couldn't take refuge in that which knows. And I'm not now speaking about the highest level, the ultimate level of, you know, full awakening or so. Just about the very simple faculty of knowing, which we can have when we sit here quietly watching the processes in our mind. Even the difficult ones. We can be connected with that in ourselves which knows. So it means which knows maybe the difference between, you know, the things arising, the objects or the activities taking place in our minds, our hearts, and also that aspect which knows. And there's a difference, isn't it? There's a difference between the two. The objects which come and go, the activities which come and go, is one thing, and that which knows is another thing, isn't it? It's not that there's two people there, but there's these two aspects. And for us, our task is to connect with that which knows. And you could call it, if you want to be a little bit more liberal, you could call it the Buddha knowing. That's the Buddha. That's the knowing one in ourselves who knows reality, who knows the fleeting sense of all sense phenomena, of all events in our minds and so forth, and knows how to stand away from that. And just witness it, just watch it, just observe it, and not getting caught up in the show, the fleeting show. So that's a refuge, yeah, if we can rest there. And the Dhamma, you know, the term Dhamma, which is always pointing to the fact of the immediacy of this watching, of this knowing. As we recite it, every night we recite this, and over and over and over again, the Dhamma is apparent here and now. Here and now, literally. And it's called timeless, a timeless quality. What does that mean, timeless? As soon as we start thinking about it, we are in time, isn't it? Thoughts, thought patterns, associations with our thinking mind moves within time. The timeless quality is again this knowing. When we are knowing, or as Lompo Someda used to put it wonderfully, when we are being the knowing, he created these terms sometimes, a bit mysterious for some people, but I really liked them because they were, he was trying to get as close as you can to that, to describe that, which is really indescribable. Being the knowing. Huh? You understand that, what that means, being the knowing? It refers to that immediacy. You don't even think about it. You just receive things as they are. You see things as they are. You allow things to be as they are. This is all being the knowing, if you can get a taste for what I'm pointing to. It's to be individually realized by the wise. And it's leading us onwards. If we do that, if we take that as our refuge, abiding there more and more, it's leading us onwards. The scholars still argue about if it's leading inwards or onwards. I don't really care. It could be both. Certainly to go inwards, to abiding within this knowing heart, with this knowing mind, it will lead us onwards. It will lead us to more awakened moments. It will lead us to more an awakened form of consciousness than we have been previously, where we have been dull and asleep. And we haven't been able to distinguish between that which knows, or which is being the knowing, and that which is the object of it, or the activities of it. And so that's a very important aspect of, you know, you could say, fundamental Buddhist reflection and inquiry, to really ponder that in your life. And the third refuge, of course, is the Sangha. We call this the Sangha, which is the community of like-minded practitioners. We have a narrow way of interpreting it, which is the Arya Sangha or the Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni Sangha, but then it is a supported network, you could say in the broad sense, a supported network of practitioners who are committed to this, to these refuges, who are committed to this Buddha knowing, to the immediacy of looking, not being victim of deciding consciously, not to be victim of one's habits, of one's thinking and feeling habits. And just to renounce that can be made as a statement to oneself. Nobody else needs to know about it. You can make that statement to yourself. I renounce any egoic investment from now on, any kind of blown up self-concern, or get carried away in my own thinking mind or in my feelings. I want to more stand in that place in myself where I can be the knowing one. And that is, we have, of course, and that would go too far to speak about this tonight. We have practices in Buddhist tradition, in our tradition, of course, where we can familiarize ourselves with that Buddha knowing, practices leading us into that more and more, making us more and more familiar with it. And most of those practices we can find in the context of the satipatthana, of the mindfulness meditation, where we're training ourselves to resting more in this knowing faculty. Because obviously, most people who look at themselves honestly and squarely, they have to, or you might say that now when you hear me speaking like that, yes, it all sounds very nice, but when I really try to do this, I don't seem to be very good at it. Or maybe I just do it for 1 second and then my mind is off on a journey around the world again. But this is not a reason to despair, because that's your reality right now. It can only be an encouragement to acknowledge, okay, these are my limitations. Obviously, some training is necessary. And so we call this, of course, the mindfulness training. Training in mindfulness, training in awareness. Because it needs re-encouraging, constant. Not only on the meditation cushion, but even in the mundane areas of our life. We can, and I would even say we need to remind ourselves of this aspect. In a conversation, even in a conflict conversation with someone, we can go and connect with this Buddha knowing. Gives us a few moments of stillness, before we react, before we say something unskillful, before we lash out with aversion or aggression. We can just abide that, oh, yeah, this doesn't feel nice. And then we can hold a bit on what would be the appropriate response. So it has also very practical application. It's not just wonderful ethereal Buddhist theory, but it can be very down to earth in its application. So that being the Buddha knowing, ideally, if it's really a refuge in our lives, then we need to apply it in all situations. No excuses for exception. Because if we do, then where do we go? We go back to the old habit, to the old habit patterns, and they haven't proved very, very beneficial and very skillful. So why not make a declaration to ourselves? I renounce the obsessive concern with myself, with me and mine. The Buddha also called it in another sutta, he called it the me-making and mind-making all the time. So he's pointing to the fact that this taking identity with ourselves as a fixed entity is a process, is a me-making and mind-making. No, we're doing it all the time. It's not a thing. It's not a fixed object which you can identify and find, but it's a continuously ongoing process. And because of that, we are under the illusion that there's somewhere in there, there's something, some entity, some fixed place or thing which does this all. And so we are encouraged to look at that. This is not true. Or even leave that away because it might sound you have to believe that this is not true. You don't have to believe that. Just look at it. Just look at your life squarely. Look at your inner life very openly, receptively. And overall, don't forget these other two aspects of the second aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, the benevolence, the kindness and benevolence towards yourself and the compassion. Because otherwise we're drifting into a very easily a negative attitude towards ourselves. We see ourselves easily in a negative light, and this would be very unfortunate. So to uphold a genuinely general benevolent attitude towards ourselves, we're doing this in order because we wish ourselves well. We want to discover more and more what the truth of our heart is really like, what is really reliable in our hearts. And we can only discover that if we are having a benevolent attitude and a compassionate attitude towards ourselves. If we're coming from self-criticism, again, just using the word self-criticism, self-judgment, even self-analysis all the time, we're not having very good cards, so to speak. So maybe tonight, and this was the theme brought up by Jean-Christophe, just to ponder this for yourself. This theme, there's many other angles to it. I just touched on a few. And I think, you know, the fundamental one, of course, is renunciation of, you know, the imagined self. And, of course, on the other side of the spectrum is the taking of refuge. If we renounce something, then where do we go? If we just keep renouncing, then we end up nowhere, don't we? So we need a refuge, a place where we can rest and be. And from there, then this process of development, inner development, or unfolding maybe is a better word, the unfolding can happen. We're unfolding things. We're seeing the veils of delusion, which are covering over the bright and shininess of the true heart, of the knowing heart, and taking them away. And when all the veils are taken away, or the shadows have had a torch or a light pointed towards, then what is left is the shining, knowing heart. And it's very, sometimes that is mentioned also in the scriptures, and that the heart, the original heart, or the knowing heart has this purity, the shine, it's a radiance, it's not limited by anything. It's unlimited qualities. And these unlimited qualities can manifest to these Brahmaviharas, as we have them in our tradition. Right? We can manifest to limitless joy and limitless compassion, limitless love, and then limitless equanimity, where you not get pummeled or confused by anything what happens in life, even the most dramatic or drastic appearances, feelings, emotions, externally, internally, you are resting, you are at peace with everything. And I think this is, for me anyway, don't know about you, this is the direction life has to go if we truly want to not only arrive at peace, but if we already now, as we are here, sitting here, we want to be resting in peacefulness right now, or at least, at the very least, to coexist peacefully with whatever arises. Can you do that? Coexist peacefully with your anger, your aversion, your fear, your pain, your jealousy, whatever state it is. Can you just coexist peacefully? Which means we're not rejecting it, not trying to push it away, trying to squash it, squeeze it, ignore it, trying to get, overcome it. We have so many strategies how we are very often in resistance to what appears in our mental, emotional continuum, isn't it? So often. So accept that you have this wonderful knowing quality, and then see what will be the result for you. You can only know yourself. Is this beneficial for me? Does this do me any good? Does this work, simply? Or is it all hocus pocus? Buddhist hocus pocus. It's up to you to decide, isn't it? You have to find out. No one else can tell you. But I always find that this is the good news, that as the Buddha also says in this phrase we chant every day, it's every individual to be experienced individually by the wise. And the wise, this is not some kind of wise, long-bearded fellow up in the mountains, the special person, the special guy. It's us, when we have the wisdom faculty switched on, when we are being the knowing, coming back to that, then we are wise. And then we can realize that. We can go beyond the constrictions of self-view, of this very narrow view of me and mine, of me-making and mind-making. So this should be enough for tonight. So I hope you gives you some food for thought. You can ponder this a little bit further for yourself. So thank you for listening.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.